Hello and welcome back to the Damage Report. Still in very much damaged times, but I appreciate you joining me this morning. We're gonna walk you through some of the latest communications from the president on the response to the current pandemic. But beyond that, we will be joined later on by not only an awesome candidate, Adrian Bell, but also by Jordan Ewell, who's gonna walk us through some of the big news of the day, including the fact that we are in an election day. I know it's probably the last thing on a lot of people's minds, and it seems insane that it's going forward, but in multiple states it will be. So we're gonna be talking about that. And then later on the show, you're gonna wanna stick around to the end, because we do have, meanwhile, an important information bearing on the current world situation from countries around the world a little bit later on. But we start with domestic news. Here is the latest from Donald Trump on coronavirus. He was asked at a recent press conference just yesterday how he thinks he is doing, considering his previous assertions that the buck stops literally anywhere else but at his desk. Here's what he thinks.
It seems to me that if we do a really good job, we'll not only hold the death down to a level that is much lower than the other way had we not done a good job. But people are talking about July, August, something like that. So it could be right in that period of time.
Okay, so there you have the president talking about what they're trying to do, which is obviously at the end of the day, prevent deaths. And if you look, I know a lot has been normalized, including sentences that mean nothing, but that was very hard to follow, wasn't it? Like, we sort of hear it, his mouth is moving, words are coming out. I'm gonna jump ahead to the control room, to the last graphic in here. We'll go back later, but I wanna read this for you. And again, this is what he said there. What can we actually learn from this? If we do a really good job, we'll not only hold the death down to a level that is not only much lower than the other way had we not done a good job, but people are talking about July, August, something like that. So it could be right in that period of time. That's like one of those sentences where you just like feed an AI like a bunch of sentences and then say, just come up with whatever you have. I don't know what that means. If we do a good job, there will be less deaths than if we don't do a good job. Okay, I can agree with that. I don't know what the July and August thing is. Maybe that is communicating that, like, deep down he knows there's something that has to do with July and August, but either he doesn't know how to communicate it or he can't actually tell us at this point. But from that sentence or from that paragraph, I don't know what that is. I assume what he wants to communicate is that, considering what they are now finally doing in the federal government in terms of encouraging the spread of these tests and all of that, and that combined with hopefully some assistance coming from Congress, that by July or August we will have a good hold on this thing. I assume that's what he means. I hope that that's what he means. But unfortunately, it's difficult to actually learn much of anything from Donald Trump. But I will say that those bills, which we've been following for the past few days, they are continuing forward. Yesterday, Louie Gohmert somehow unilaterally stopped a bill from advancing to the Senate that was supposed to aid people who are currently already experiencing economic hardship as a result of the pandemic. They're gonna try again. It kind of looks like maybe Republicans and Democrats are agreeing finally that something needs to be done, but exactly what form that will come in, I can't necessarily say. There have been some leaked details from the Trump administration. I believe Larry Kudlow implied that there is going to be this package that might reach $850 billion. Now, that is not assistance to individuals necessarily. Some might be included in that. For the most part, that is bailouts of a number of different industries, including definitely the airlines. They're talking about giving $56 billion to the airlines, which obviously are very hard hit and all of that, but also banks and things like that. Their focus still appears to be, for the most part, on Wall Street. And I understand that they're worried that if casinos shut down, people will lose their jobs. That definitely seems true. The restaurant industry is gonna be hit very hard, but the focus very much is on stabilizing the industries, and hopefully that will have an effect on helping out individuals. The minority position seems to be, let's help the people directly. Now, I hope there are some good advocates for that position. Representative Ilhan Omar, she is pushing for effectively a limited term UBI. That is an idea that we are seeing start to spread, and that seems like a good starting off point. We'll see if that's what they end up landing on. The good money is always on, they're gonna give billions of dollars to industries. So that seems more likely at this point. Aside from that, Donald Trump has been noted to have changed his tone in recent days. He appears to be taking this thing more seriously, and even that garbled nonsense that we played for you before, that was his attempt at like gravitas or understanding. Like it was a little bit more toned down, to be fair. But unfortunately, that doesn't mean that his worst excesses have gone away or that he's not following the lead of right-wing media to this day. And one way that that is very clear was in this tweet earlier today. Cuomo wants all states to be treated the same, but all states aren't the same. Some are being hit hard by the Chinese virus. Some are being hit practically not at all. He goes on to continue to attack New York. I believe, look, I don't feel like my job here is to defend Governor Cuomo. I believe what he's saying is that we need to be ready for all states to potentially have outbreaks of this sort. I don't know what Trump thinks he was saying, but I did notice, and I assume you noticed, the Chinese virus reference there, because that's the thing that they're doing right now. They started almost 2 weeks ago on Fox News trying to refer to it as the Chinese coronavirus, the Wuhan coronavirus. And now they've simplified it. It's just the Chinese virus. And to be very clear, the WHO has advised against terms that link the virus to China or the city of Wuhan, where it was first detected, in order to avoid discrimination or stigmatization. And I know that some right-wingers who are physically incapable of feeling empathy for individuals will say, well, what do I care about that PC language? I don't care if I offend China. I understand that. But there are individuals who are either Chinese in America or people think that they are even though they're not. And those individuals are being discriminated against, stigmatized. Their businesses are being devastated by the assumption that they are harbors of the disease. And in some cases, they're being harassed and even attacked. I personally feel like in a time of a pandemic and an economic crisis like we're in, literally the last thing that we need to do is be going out of our way to try to attack other people, create scapegoats and all of that. But they've landed on that. Maybe he's taking the disease more seriously, but there's also this new, more pronounced strain of racism and xenophobia, and it's not just Trump. A reporter had this to say on Twitter this morning. A White House official referred to coronavirus as the Kung Flu to my face. Makes me wonder what they're calling it behind my back. It makes me wonder as well. That was a White House official, which, look, she is keeping to, I guess, it's off the record, so she's not naming the individual. Certainly, I wonder. I do know that right-wing media is even worse. This ghoul at the Daily Wire calls it the Woo Flu and Chop Fluey. Now, I can't read minds. I say that all the time, but I believe in this case I can read his mind. And he definitely believes that he's funny. He believes, like, you know, all that stuff about Jon Stewart and John Oliver and Trevor Noah, they think they're so funny. They're not funny. Right-wingers are funny. Look at me, people are dying around me. It's the Chop Fluey. I'm a satirist. I'm funny. Does this not give off strong, like, orchestra on the Titanic vibes? That, like, that orchestra kept playing as everything went down, except that them, it's just they're gonna get in as many racist jokes as they can before this whole thing capsizes. It's kind of what it feels like at this point. Anyway, we're gonna continue to follow the people who are actually trying to help the situation. Good luck to them, because the opposition, even inside of DC, to this day remains strong. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a short break, but lots more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
As this whole thing has developed, a lot of people have wondered how better we might have been prepared if the pandemic sort of emergency response team had not been disbanded by the Trump administration back in 2018. Of course, to be fair, he doesn't even acknowledge that he was involved in that. You remember this video?
You said that you don't take responsibility, but you did disband the White House pandemic office, and the officials that were working in that office left this administration abruptly. So what responsibility do you take to that?
Well, I just think it's a nasty question, because what we've done is, and Tony has said numerous times that we've saved thousands of lives because of the quick closing. And when you say me, I didn't do it. We have a group of people. I could ask perhaps my administration, but I could perhaps ask Tony about that, because I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, he doesn't know anything about it. Turns out that's not true. We've got the evidence, which we'll turn to in just a moment. But joining us now to discuss this and much more, Jordan Yule, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So before we get to the video, just quick, How are you processing all this? I'm curious how things have been going for you.
I work from home, so this nothing really changes
for me. Smooth transition for you?
Yeah, I it could be much worse. So I don't want to make light of the entire situation. I am concerned about, you know, my friends and family who don't have it in the same situation. But right now for me, I'm okay.
Okay, well that is certainly good, and we hope that the government takes steps to make sure that everyone is as lucky as some of us. But let's go now to the video. This is from back in 2018, Trump being asked about the closure of the pandemic response team and more.
Called for enormous cuts to the CDC, the NIH, and the WHO. You've talked a lot today about how these professionals are excellent, how they're critical and necessary. Does this experience at all give you pause about those?
No, because we can get money and we can increase staff. We know all the people. We know all the good people. It was a question I asked the doctors before. Some of the people we cut, they haven't been used for many, many years. And if we have a need, we can get them very quickly. And rather than spending the money, and I'm a business person, I don't like having thousands of people around when you don't need them. When we need them, we can get them back very quickly.
Yeah, so see, the weird thing was he was saying there, I don't like having them around, not Tony doesn't like having, hey Tony, you don't like having them around, right? Maybe we should get rid of them.
Yeah, he's really scrambling, and this is a really good look at how unprepared and inadequate he is at handling a national crisis, and in this case, a global crisis. In the past, he's tried to lie and had Fox and other GOP spokespeople run cover for him in the media and just, you know, deny the severity of different issues here and there as they popped up. But there's no denying this. And there's a clear record of what they did getting rid of this pandemic response team or experts in this field was really short-sighted, and it didn't have any it just re-emphasizes that he is completely unprepared and inadequate at this job.
Yeah, and let's just point out, so his plan there is it's a waste of money. We don't need him right now. After all, we're not in the middle of a pandemic. And I think that that's an interesting philosophy. I think that we should disband the military until there's a military emergency. I think that FEMA should be wound down, and you know, if there's a disaster, we'll just create FEMA again. We know good people, we'll call them up. Like fire departments, I'm not on fire. Let's get rid of those. And if we need to, we will build fire trucks if and when a fire develops.
Yeah, I think that's a great strategy of governance, John. Yeah. So that's with you, John for president.
You know,
no, go ahead.
That's a terrible idea. Let's not go there. Look, in a little bit, we're going to turn to what effect this might be having on people's sort of views on the government and healthcare and what that should look like. We'll turn to that in a little bit. But I'm wondering, do you think that there's any chance that people might, that they might be awakened to the idea that this is like conservative philosophy at play, the idea that the government should be irrelevant, it should be tiny, you should be able to drown in a bathtub. But oh no, we live in a dangerous world. Sometimes you do need a competent government.
Yeah, I mean, this really exposes flaws in a lot of their political ideologies. They want a small, limited government. They want states' rights. Let's just take that for example. This is a perfect example of how having this kind of like fractured system and always fighting against a federal oversight aggravated this problem, right? So you have a virus that can transfer wherever, however, just by free flow of travel. But when you have states with different levels of response, or in some cases, no response whatsoever, collectively, you're as strong as your weakest link. So if Texas, a densely populated state, isn't doing anything to fight this or doing any education or whatsoever, it's going to continue to spread because people are refusing to do anything. When you have governors of states, Republican states, saying, oh, everything's fine, go out to dinner, go to restaurants against the CDC's guidelines, you're going to see spikes there. Yep. But not just there, if people come and go and they don't recognize it because this is so dangerous, because you're spreading it whether you know you have it or not at the onset because of the incubation period, it's going to spread as you continue to go about your daily lives. And because it has an exponential growth factor, because it's so contagious, it's going to affect all of us.
Yeah.
So it's a perfect example of why this Republican experiment in governance is so deeply flawed.
Yeah, and it strikes me that the only thing worse than us being as weak, only as strong as our weakest link, is that our weakest link is still in charge, which seems like a bad call. But let's turn to a related issue right now. We know that in response to the current pandemic, there are plans to, for instance, make testing free. And you know, a lot of people who've been advocating for Medicare for All have been making the case that this would be a great, like if we had it, we would be weathering this much better. Obviously, Bernie Sanders brought that up at the last debate. We have some evidence that that is starting to affect people. Before we get into the evidence though, what do you think about this as a demonstration of how our healthcare system is currently constructed and how it might have gone if we had the sort of healthcare system that a lot of Western countries have?
Yeah, this is really highlighting the deep inadequacies of our healthcare system. And also, like when you have a government, capitalist focused government, trying to procure exclusive rights to an antidote, to treatment methods, I mean, that is just so warped. That what I really want to say, I can't say because your show's TV14. It is just so evil. It's so malicious. But on the healthcare system, when we see this really hit its peak, that's like deeply, that's dangerous. Because you have a for-profit model in our healthcare system, unlike most other developed countries. And what that's going to aggravate is the low supply. You have no incentive for these companies to produce supplies if they are not getting paid. And you have like all these different mechanisms and loopholes and ways for companies to deny people's claims. So what we're going, and on top of that, you have millions of people who are uninsured. So through no fault of their own, through a government lack of response and lack of immediacy that aggravated this problem, you're going to see people spiral into medical debt because of both a poor response from the government and a broken healthcare system that is so evil. And while people point to Italy, like Joe Biden did during the debate, Italy's universal healthcare system is what is preventing it from getting much worse. So it's important to remember that. I almost blew my lid when he said that because it is so inaccurate.
Yeah, and also, so you rightfully point out we have many people still, years and years after the ACA, we have millions and millions of people that are not insured. And as of right now, still most people get their health insurance through their jobs. We're in a situation where people need health insurance and soon a lot of these jobs might disappear. That seems like a bad idea, and it seems like a reminder that making your healthcare not contingent on who happens to be employing you right now, that seems like a good idea going forward.
Yeah, there's just so many different ways that you could really get tripped up on this. I've talked about this on my podcast recently. For me, I switch healthcare providers at the end of this month, and I know that's coming. And I know I'm deeply privileged where I have healthcare now, and I know I'll have it next month. But those ends sometimes do not always meet, and that is not always a fluid process. And I am deeply concerned about possibly getting it and then being stuck in a situation where I have to consider getting medical treatment during that overlap period where I don't know if the healthcare has been kicked in yet for the next carrier, because it's different, a different carrier. Things like that are so absolutely unnecessary and totally preventable. But it's pitfalls like that, people not having insurance or people having a high deductible, basically useless plans, which cause headaches, unnecessary headaches. But it's all because these for-profit corporate monsters in the healthcare world just want to get rich and enrich their shareholders.
Yeah, and really fast, just to close, I think a lot of people are catching up to us on some of these positions. Polling shows 76% support free testing, 75% support free vaccine, 53% support free healthcare going forward, 66% support paid sick leave, and 68% paid family leave. I would say to the 24 to 25% who think that you should still have to pay for your testing and your vaccine for this, what is wrong with you people? We have a pandemic sweeping across our country, and you think they should have to pay. I will never understand some humans.
It's so cruel. People who are stockpiling supplies to try to price gouge others on Amazon. What is wrong with you? Who hurt you? I just want to just give them a hug. Come on, who hurt you? Let's get through this together. It does not need to be like this.
Exactly. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to with Jordan Yule.
This is a state matter. But I'm asking your position as Tom Perez, the head of DNC. Sure. My understanding is you're saying you agree with the states that are going forward.
Yes, we respect what they're doing.
Okay, that's the head of the DNC, respects what the states are doing. I'm going to say I don't respect what Tom Perez is doing right there. We're in an election day, even though significant portions of the country are currently locked down and told not to congregate in groups above 50. At the same time, they're being told you should get in lines of potentially hundreds of people and stand there for literally hours. Seems like a bad idea, but we're joined now by Jordan Yule. Maybe he'll disagree. Jordan, what do you think about this?
No, I think this is an absolutely reckless decision. I think Ohio, and this really pains me to say this as a Ohioan, as someone who has just grown to hate Mike DeWine over the years for his archaic, regressive style of governance and politics. Mike DeWine led the way on this issue. He said, look, we're going to delay in-person voting until June. We will expand absentee ballot voting. This is the safest way to do it. We don't need people congregating, but that also shouldn't influence or have any effect on your ability to exercise your right to vote. Mm-hmm. That is a great solution, a great response. And Illinois, Arizona, and Florida should have followed suit. Instead, we have now reports of abnormally low voter turnout in areas like Chicago, because people are rightfully concerned about their well-being, and they shouldn't have ever been forced into this decision where they needed to choose. People just count on in-person voting, and sometimes people enjoy it. They like the experience of it. That's fine. And they should be able to do that safely without having to risk catching some potentially life-threatening virus. Yeah. So for the Democratic leadership to applaud this move is so absolutely warped and this absolutely repugnant decision, because now people's lives could be at stake.
Yeah, I have this weird thing where I like to point out when I've been naive. When Ohio announced that yesterday, I thought, well, that puts a lot of pressure on these other states, because now if they don't cancel it, then they're gonna look like they don't care about the lives of their people. Well, the joke's on me and the people of these states, because that pressure didn't work and they're going forward. And I think of course there's gonna be super low turnout. So we're gonna have a sort of democratic crisis, but that's preferable to hundreds of thousands of additional people being infected with coronavirus, theoretically, because they're forced to go vote. Like, I was lucky enough, I was able to go vote, and there was a very, very low chance that I would die as a result of it. I think in America, everyone should be given that same opportunity.
Yeah, you would think, and it's a bit rich to see some of these Democratic establishment groups cheer this on yesterday.
Yeah.
And condemn Ohio's decision, which was just so flabbergasting.
So let me
these are groups
you,
that always talk about.
Oh, no, sorry, continue. Yeah.
Oh, well, these are groups that always talk about how we need to expand access to voting. And here you have a state saying, look, you get 2 more months to vote. That's great. I don't understand the response that was so negative from these Democratic establishment groups. And now today, same people are on Twitter like, oh wow, we're seeing polling locations closed. Please call our voter hotline. This isn't fair. What did you expect? We're in a global pandemic. What were you expecting was going to happen? People just come up immune to it?
Yeah, exactly. Eager to work, to interact yeah. with thousands of people. Yeah, let's jump ahead to a couple of these examples. Now, some of this is anecdotal, bear that in mind, but one woman tweeted, election day so far, 5 out of 8 election staff are elderly. We were provided with no cleaning supplies. We're missing an entire blue box, meaning anyone who comes to this precinct can't vote. We're missing 2 election judges and nobody is answering our calls. Obviously, those 5 out of 8 election staff that are elderly are very brave to show up, but they shouldn't be put in that situation. The AP says some Florida polling places couldn't open because workers, fearing the virus, stayed away. The clerk in the county where Chicago is located encouraged workers to mark space on the floor to keep voters apart and avoid possibly spreading the virus. And this, I couldn't have predicted this exact outcome, but all of this is eminently predictable that these sorts of disasters would happen if they decided to go forward.
Yeah, you should have known this was going to happen. And good on Ohio for taking a last minute action again. And it's just like, it's really infuriating that some of these groups are trying to turn this into some weird, like to reverse voter suppression through extending voting and absentee voting for months. To make sure everyone has a right to vote. I think this is establishment groups trying to get one more election in, just trying to extend the lead for Biden a little bit so they can turn around and be like, you know what, this is a global crisis. We need to work. We need to focus on fighting Trump. We need to focus on getting through this together. Bernie should drop out. I do not be surprised if later in this week you start to hear people and people in the media and people at these establishment political groups say the exact same thing. I think this is an absolute ploy. They knew what they were doing.
It's funny. I thought that that was so apparent that I didn't even bring it up. Like, what other excuse could there possibly be for going forward and being no, it's totally safe. I mean, you shouldn't have 14 people in a McDonald's, but definitely line up. Totally safe, no problems there. I think this is obviously designed to maximize the benefit that Joe Biden currently has in the polls, and he's already starting to move down a little bit as of this morning. It's callous and it's cruel, and that's the party leadership, I guess. But let's move to one other aspect of the story. We've got leaders in both the Democratic and now the Republican Party saying that we need to do whatever we can to help people in this situation, including possibly some form of limited universal basic income. But not everybody on the right is buying it. Here's Tucker Carlson.
1 million jobs could vanish in the month of April. 1 million people suddenly without jobs. That's the nightmare scenario. Countries with high unemployment are desperate countries, and more ominous, they are unstable countries always. You don't want that. Some of the professional class have suggested a guaranteed basic income as a response to this threat. Mitt Romney has suggested sending every American a monthly check for $1,000. That's likely a well-meaning idea. A lot of smart people are behind it, but it's also decadent and foolish. Name a place that's become happier and more prosperous under a scheme like that. Indian reservations? The inner city, rural areas where half the male population gets monthly disability checks? Or for that matter, if we're being honest, how many happily idle inherited money people do you know? Rich people? None. They're all drunk. Of course they are. People need to work. They want to work. Work gives them meaning and purpose and dignity. That's not some hollow slogan.
Okay, so how many like idle rich are happy, said heir to a fortune Tucker Carlson, who talks for an hour a day into a look. This is my job. It's pretty idle. I'm gonna keep it real, but he gets paid far more than me. And did you notice that he fit in there where schemes like this exist? He fit in the inner city and then immediately moved on, implying that we just give $1,000 to everyone in the inner city every month.
Yeah, yet again, Tucker's racism and bigotry, he has to force it into every issue. Because that's often the scare tactic, and that plays into the welfare queen stereotype. No, I mean, it's also like just we're going to see like a serious economic downturn where millions of people could lose their jobs. There is no safety net to prepare for that. And that we have people like Mitt Romney, of all people, advocating for some sort of UBI or some sort of direct injection of cash to like the consumer class, like the driving force of the economy, the middle class and working people. That should really show what people expect. But you know, Tucker sitting on his tens of millions of dollars, the owner of a private jet, someone who, you know, gets paid a ridiculous amount of money to shout into a camera an hour a night. He thinks that's a bad idea. It really demonstrates his privilege, his disconnect from the issue, and how he hasn't really considered the working experience of so many people.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious. Like some sort of stimulus has happened before. It happened, you know, a decade ago, but not in the form of basically UBI, and in particular, $1,000 a month UBI. Do we owe this to the Lord and Savior of hashtag math? Is this Andrew Yang that created a situation where that's the default proposal that people are going with?
I mean, you have to give them credit. I think when you have people who run on single issue campaigns like that, and not just, he had a full platform, but he was mostly known for UBI. When you have people who do that, who talk about those issues in single issue campaigns, they help move the ball a little bit. And while he didn't invent the concept, he definitely helped normalize it. And that learning curve and getting people accustomed to that idea and that concept is a huge hurdle. So for that reason, yeah, sure, Andrew Yang played a big part in this. And while I don't agree with his specific approach on a national level, like he wanted to gut other social safety net programs, which I do not agree with, just the concept of UBI in general, he helped familiarize the American people with. And that's great. We owe him a big thank you.
I couldn't agree more. As always, Jordan Yule, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully, we'll be talking pretty regularly as we proceed through with this thing.
Always here for you, John.
Thank you. We're gonna take a short break, but a candidate joins us on the other side. Joining us now on the show is congressional candidate running in Texas's 14th district, Adrienne Bell. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Very glad to have you on, and very glad, by the way, just fairly recently to see that you've made it through your primary. You beat, it was four challengers. You got 62%, I believe. So certainly congratulations are in order.
Thank you. We are so excited about the momentum that's being built in Texas 14 and the landslide victory that we had. We were told that we could not or would not win this election without a runoff because we had so many opponents, and we showed them wrong.
So look, you probably don't remember, but we talked literally years ago in a previous run. And so it's another reason why it's great to see you succeed at this point. There were people who didn't think that it would be such a dominant win, that, like you said, it would go to a runoff. Why do you believe it turned out so much in your favor this time around?
It was a good thing that we ran in 2018. We received 92,000 votes in the general election in 2018. And so going into the 2020 primary, we could just build on the momentum, the name recognition that we have received, continue building out in the field. And that's what we did. We didn't have to start from scratch, zero, like we did in the 2018 midterm election. And so we were able to continue building. We went to, we have three counties in this area. We continued building in each county. People knew who we were. And so it wasn't just starting from the beginning. It was just building on what was already known about our campaign, what we stood for, and then my work as a teacher in the public school system.
You know, in case people might not be familiar with past appearances that you've had, either on The Damage Report or on other shows on the TYT network, could you tell some of those newer viewers about your platform, where you're coming from?
Exactly. I am standing for Medicare for all. And when you look at the state of our economic stability in our country today with the coronavirus, we see that Medicare for all, the policies that we've been pushing, are the ones that we need. I also stand for criminal justice reform. There are too many black and brown men that are locked up in prisons and that are taken away from their families. Also, public education is a huge part of our platform. As a public school teacher, I'm in the classroom Monday through Friday. I see firsthand the struggles of public education in our classrooms, the STAR testing that we are teaching to STAR test, and not allowing our children to be creative, being to grow in their own knowledge, but to test to teach to a test. And so these policies that we've been pushing as progressives, we're seeing right now are the policies that we need to be able to sustain what we're getting ready to face and what workers are facing today as we speak, when restaurants and bars are being closed and people still have bills. Their income has decreased, anxieties have increased. And so what are we going to do? So the policies that we've been pushing for, that we've been standing for, are being shown as the policies that we need in America.
I couldn't agree more. We've been saying much the same thing for some time here. I'm curious, as you've been watching the conversation nationally develop, like you're hearing from potential constituents about how this is impacting them, and you've seen different proposals being talked about, how can we in the short term, in the midterm, help people? What are some of the things that you think that you'd like to see done to try to stabilize things?
Well, for one thing, people need a cash payout. We need some income into our pockets. We also need a national moratorium on mortgage and rent payments. We have seen in the Gulf Coast with hurricanes, the latest being Hurricane Harvey, of how people suffered and how people had to wait for FEMA relief and still waiting. We still have buildings that are not repaired. We still have homes that are not repaired from that disaster. And so today, when you start compounding those issues on the people that are in Texas 14 along this Gulf Coast area, it just makes it harder. The current representative in Texas 14 voted against the coronavirus bill, voted against families being able to take care of their families, voted against working people who right now are at home. Tip workers who barely make a living as it is and cannot make a living without tips are at home. What are we supposed to do? How are people supposed to survive? Those are the things that just keep resounding to me. What are we going to do? We go to the grocery stores. There's no toilet paper. Food is being run out. I am a school teacher. We are out of school in our district until April 10th. That's 3 weeks. That's teaching our children at home. And so I have a heart for parents who are seeking, who have to pay additional child care, who have to homeschool their children now. Our children cannot afford to sit at home and play video games. And so the public education system is under a test. It is going to be under a transition to get our students to be able to do online learning. It's something we can do, but it's something we've got to prepare for. Also, vote by mail ballots. We've got to change our voting system so that our primaries, our runoffs are not being hampered because of the coronavirus and being able to go to the polls and vote.
Agreed. You know, I was going to ask you, now that you've moved past the primary and you're focusing on Randy Weber, the current GOP incumbent, you know, what your strategy is going to look like going forward, how it's going to have to shift. But I would assume that vote against the coronavirus relief bill, I assume that's probably going to show up in your campaign.
Absolutely. When you vote against the relief of I tell people, the people of Texas 14 will put me into office. But when I get to Congress, my vote is going to impact Americans all across the nation. So his vote to say no to the coronavirus bill means that he voted no against all Americans, all working families, all single parents. He voted no against families being able to receive Medicare and Medicaid. You know, Texas has the highest uninsured population in the nation. And when you start voting against the American people have got to vote against you. It is time for leadership right now that is strong, that is effective, that is standing up for the people. And in Texas 14, that representative does not exist. And so it just shows the other 39 Republicans who voted against this bill where their mindset is. It is not for the people.
And where can people find out more about your platform?
My website is voteforbail.com. That's VOTEBELL.com. We need volunteers. Our grassroots organization is built on people. This is a people-powered movement. Without people and movement, it won't survive, because our goal is to go to Washington, D.C. to take back this seat of Texas 14 that is not serving the people. So it's going to take the people's effort into getting that done. Across the nation, we are accepting contributions at voteforbail.com. We have virtual phone banks, so you can call from around the country to help us get the word out that there is change that is going on in Texas 14. And there is a leader, Adrian Bell, who is willing to step up to the plate and fight for the people.
Adrienne Bell for Texas's 14th District. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John, for having me today. Take care.
You too. We're going to take one last break, but meanwhile, in after this. And now it's time for news from around the world, and meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Gabon, a haven for a number of different primate species, including gorillas and chimpanzees. They don't want you going anywhere near them because you're sick. And I think understandably their position. The Central African nation has only one confirmed COVID-19 case so far, but fears linger after an Ebola epidemic back in 1995 wiped out more than 90% of the gorillas in the northern part of the country. Devastating legacy that they obviously don't want to resume. And the director of operations for one of the national agencies for parks there said, "We've decided to close tourist activities for viewing the great apes in our parks to avoid any risk of transmissions between humans and the animals. The respiratory viruses that affect humans are easily transmitted to great apes because the two species are so closely related." And so I had not even thought about that. One of the reasons we're including this story today is because you probably too had not thought about that. We've, you know, asked questions about whether our pets can get this and this sort of thing. But some animal species are very vulnerable for it and obviously would not receive the same sort of medical care if they got it. And so a temporary shutdown of tourist activity until the nationwide, or the, I should say, the international situation around this is probably not a bad idea. But in that country, gorillas, chimpanzees are not the only animals that views are changing towards. Pangolins were once prized items in the markets of Gabon's capital, Libreville. But bushmeat sellers have started hiding the small scaly mammals behind boar legs and porcupine carcasses. So understand the context of this. They were considered the most trafficked animal in the world up until very recently, possibly still. But because of the links, either in reality or in belief, between these little creatures, which are, I think we can agree, absolutely adorable, and COVID-19, suddenly people's minds are changing on that. Trading the endangered animal, considered to be the most poached in the world, is illegal in the country now. But that's not why the merchants are hiding their stocks. A team of Chinese researchers suspect that they are the ones who transmitted the novel coronavirus to humans at another game market in the city of Wuhan. And so, look, you've probably heard about the possibility of rats, the possibility of bats, but those cute little critters too are receiving some of the blame. But for the moment, not everyone is worried. With only one case so far in the country, bushmeat lovers are not necessarily discouraged. One vegetable seller there said, "We've been told about monkey, which would give Ebola, and yet we've kept eating it and never got that." And so for the humble pangolin, the trafficking situation, the consumption situation hasn't necessarily fundamentally changed. But right now, people seem to be treading carefully. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, around the world, are you shocked to find out that things have continued to heat up? The months of December, January, and February, which meteorologists define as winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, were the second warmest on record. That was announced last Friday. Only the El Nino-fueled winter of 2015 to 2016 was warmer, according to NOAA. Now, I'll give you a few examples. Some of the most extreme warmth was in Russia, which smashed its record for warmest winter. Temperatures there were as much as 12 degrees above average, which is just insane. This weird warmth messed with the region's flora and fauna. Flowers started to bloom early in the winter. Some bears even awoke from hibernation at the zoo early, which is obviously problematic. And that is also having problems, like we talked not too many weeks ago, about locust swarms, which are being impacted by climate change as well. So this is significant. But understand that while we all have a part to play in dealing with this, we're not all equally responsible for it. The rich apparently are more to blame for the global climate crisis, according to a study by the University of Leeds, looking at 86 different countries. The wealthiest 10% of people consume about 20 times more energy overall than the bottom 10, wherever they live. The Gulf is greatest in transport, where the top 10th gobble up 187 times more fuel than the poorest 10th. That's because people on the lowest incomes can rarely afford to drive. So, huge situation. Obviously, we need to all get together to deal with it. But that doesn't mean that we can't identify where a disproportionate amount of the problem is coming from. Okay, with that, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of The Damage Report. I don't know for sure what the show is going to look like in future days and weeks. We will be around though, and we appreciate you sticking with us during this difficult situation. And with that, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.